House and Senate negotiators meeting today to try to move closer to a deal on a budget for the rest of fiscal 2014. The sides are still far apart on numbers, and they have very little time to reach a deal that prevents sequestration January 15th. David Berteaux and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies are looking at how a conference committee deal might impact the Department of Defense for the remainder of 2014 and for the out years. Today on Pentagon Solutions, they're my guest to talk about that issue. Dave Berteaux says that January 15th deadline is really a double deadline.
One is it's the expiration of the continuing resolution under which all government functions are continuing to operate or have appropriations to operate, including most Defense Department functions. The other is it's the deadline for the actual use of the sequester tool if, in fact, the government's operating under an appropriation that's higher than the final Budget Control Act caps. For DOD, this is particularly important because the difference between the continuing resolution level of spending and the Budget Control Act final cap level of spending is substantial. It's about $18 billion. So January 15th matters to them in two ways. The second, though, is that with each passing day, obviously we're getting closer to it, and until there's a deal, you can't write the appropriations bills necessary to avoid that cliff, if you will.
That's why we're seeing Senator Mikulski and Congressman Rogers, the chairs of the appropriations committees, asking for a number. And I think it's significant, Ryan, that they're not asking for a particular number. They're just saying, give us a number.
Yeah, I think we're really hitting the tipping point where uncertainty is the biggest fear of everyone. And so certainty at any level, whether you're inside of DOD and you're having to do the annual planning, I mean, we're coming up on a 15 budget, or whether you're in industry, in the contracting community and industry, or in the financial markets or strategic planning, certainty is suddenly becoming the most important thing, not the level of that certainty.
What is the you and Dave write about the combination of the debt limit increases and the sequestration and budget funding? Is that part of the problem here, that we have these two things that aren't really connected now connected? And would it benefit Congress and would it benefit the Defense Department for them to be separated and back on their own tracks as they were for many years?
Well, I think the problem is not just that they are have suddenly become tied together. It's that they're also being frequently tied together. I think particularly with the debt limit, we're looking at a situation where we haven't been able to move past it. We have done short punts over and over. This has the same impact of a number of CRs. You know, we're starting to hit the point where it is we can't come to a deal because it's the same questions coming up every 3 to 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really get past the politics of that easily.
It's also true that for years, actually, we would link the two together. You know, if you go back to earlier times where we had budget resolutions, you would actually deem the level of the budget resolution to be the increase in the debt ceiling if you needed it to be that. But now we're only dealing with it when we get close to the edge, if you will, rather than planning ahead. So it's the time frame of it as well.
How do we get back on track, or is that just as simple as Congress deciding we're not going to do it this way anymore?
I think Congress will have to decide we're not going to do it this way anymore. Right now, I don't see the incentive structure for them to do it or where the votes would come from. So I think the two will stay linked, will remain linked for some time.
And I'm certainly not suggesting that it's easy or that anybody intends to do it.
Well, and particularly now what they've figured out is they actually don't have to vote to increase the debt ceiling. What they do is they vote to suspend the debt ceiling, and then when there's put a date certain at which it gets reinstated. So nobody actually votes to raise the debt ceiling, so it's a safer vote.
They're very clever, aren't they? They've been doing this for a while. Some of the things that we talked about before we went on the air included this idea of asking for a number rather than a particular number. And I find that encouraging, I have to say, gentlemen, because that sounds to me like, as you alluded to, Ryan, they've gotten over the hump of what's the number going to be and are saying we're prepared to get to regular order when you have a Republican House Appropriations Chair and a Democratic Senate Appropriations Chair saying the same thing together. I take that as a pretty encouraging sign. Am I a little too Pollyannish, Dave?
Well, I don't think it's Pollyannish view. I think that when the two appropriators or the two budget people who are this far apart are thinking in terms of appropriations as well as budget, that's now you have the basis for, in fact, an agreement, not a deal, but an agreement that could lead to appropriations and could lead to allocations by subcommittee with some flexibility built into it. So, in fact, you could fund the more important things and leave less well-funded the lesser important things. That's not something that a blunt sequestration under the Budget Control Act can do. So I think even the executive branch agencies would prefer the certainty with the flexibility at a lower number rather than the uncertainty of a higher number with no flexibility.
Let's talk about the numbers a little bit, Ryan. The continuing resolution provides for funding at the $986 billion level. The Budget Control Act number is $967 billion. And so those are the cuts that would take place, you know, on a sliding scale come January 15th. Do you have a sense that some of the things that we're hearing, especially when the Joint Chiefs go to Capitol Hill to talk about sequestration, what it would look like in 14, do you have a sense that things will be as bad as they make them sound? Because they make them sound really, really bad.
Well, I think that that they have been playing that hand for a long time, and it's starting to come off as very one note. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it resonates like it did back a year and a half ago when we were all sitting down saying, well, at least this will actually never happen. I mean, sequestration, that's just crazy. But that being said, I actually think there are significant concerns that are a little bit buried right now because we haven't been getting those too many stories about what happened in 13 in terms of sequestration. But I think that 14 is when it does start to build a little bit and it starts to get a little more worrisome. You know, we have this cut that is already, you know, was $34 billion down to the CR level, another $18 billion to get down to the BCA level. But there are things that stack up on top of that, something that's also in the piece, where you look at the deferred spending from FY13, you know, maintenance and such things that just didn't happen because we didn't have the money and we figured we'd punt that off to 14. Well, you can't punt maintenance forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we also had outlays in FY13. You know, there's a relatively limited impact of budget authority for 1 year in the year that it's actually authorized. And some of those impacts actually multiply in the following years. And there's cost growth inside the department that squeezes out other money. There are a lot of factors that become cumulative beyond just the concerns within, of the top line level changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you're most likely to see some of the bad outcomes in 14 and beyond if the sequester level continues.
Dave, one of the arguments that the chiefs use is, well, we had some money that wasn't spent in FY12, and we could use that to mitigate, to blunt some of the effects of the sequester in 13. We did that in 13. That means we don't have that tool to use in 14.
They're right.
That sounds that like that's their best argument in this, though.
It's certainly an important argument, and it's an argument actually that gets back to the question of certainty versus certainty at a lower number versus uncertainty at no number.
Mm.
If you approach the way you manage this shortfall 1 year at a time, you make very different decisions than if you say, I may be at this for a while, and then you'll make different decisions as you go forward. So you can't defer as much. I think there's another element, though, that comes into play. In fact, you had Admiral Harvey in for a series of interviews a week or two ago, and he raised a very important question on this readiness issue, which is ready for what? You know, the idea that we only have two brigade combat teams that are ready for full spectrum combat that are not already geared to deploying to Afghanistan sounds like a very low number when you have 43 brigade combat teams. But nobody knows the answer to the question, well, if it's not two, then what number should it be? Probably not all the rest of them, right? So there's some number in between. And that's a very difficult question. And that's part of what I think the Quadrennial Defense Review is supposed to do and the QDR report that would come out in January or February or whenever the budget goes forward.
But my sense of that, and I got into that a little bit with Admiral Harvey, is we have now, I can think of off the top of my head, four current policy and planning documents. And it's hard for me as an outsider, maybe you can tell me more as somebody who's in the building periodically, about which one do we pay the most attention to, or do we put them all aside when the 14 QDR comes out, and that's it from now on?
Well, and there's another big question. Your question is a good one. Which ones do you pay attention to? Which ones precede which? But it's also at what budget level?
Right.
You know, Ryan mentioned we're building the FY 2015 budget right now inside not only DOD but across the federal government. You have to not only assume what is your fiscal year 14 starting point for that budget, we don't know that yet, but are you going to submit that budget at a level that's compliant with the final Budget Control Act caps, or are you going to submit it at a much higher level and go through this same, essentially, the drill we've just done this year? Will you go through that drill next year? We don't have a clue yet which one it is. So how do you, if your strategy is, in fact, partly connected to your resources, how do you do it when you don't know what those resources are?
That's David Berteau of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, along with his colleague Ryan Crotty, and they are writing about the impact of a budget deal on the defense budget. You can read that link later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And more from Dave and Ryan on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio.
AM.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Pentagon Solutions every Wednesday in the 4 o'clock hour. Senator Harry Reid says debate starts this week on the National Defense Authorization Act. That bill will fund the Defense Department at a rate of $526 billion for the rest of this fiscal year. The problem is the Budget Control Act cap for this year is $475 billion, and the Overseas Contingency Operation budget is not going away either. That adds another $79 billion to the total. Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies are looking at how the OCO budget either connects to or separates from the base DOD budget. Berteau says that issue is complicated for three reasons.
One, of course, is your rationale for having a large overseas contingency operation account, the OCO account, is the deployed forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, not there in Iraq, soon not to be there in Afghanistan. So at one level, your argument of why you need to spend $80 or $90 billion a year is diminished. On the other hand, a lot of the costs associated with those deployments, particularly the reset of the equipment that's worn out and has to be brought back, will extend for years beyond that. How do you pay for that without an OCO? One of the things that we want to watch very carefully, though, is OCO is not exempt from sequestration, but it's part of the floor by which you calculate the percentages of the reduction. On the other hand, OCO is, in fact, less subject to it's okay to get by with 10% or 15% less of it because it has real purposes for real deployed forces. So it's a delicate managing balance as well going forward. The third, though, is it's a safety valve. What you can't put in your regular budget, you can put in OCO. And, in fact, you saw in the fiscal year 14 appropriations markups, the committees actually increased the Defense Department's request for OCO, even though there was no argument by the Defense Department that they needed an increased number because it was a safety valve.
Mm-hmm.
So you got multiple dynamics there, all of which say OCO is still valuable. At the same time, the rationale for it is going down.
And that's the dichotomy there that I find fascinating. The NDAA that Senator Reid is going to bring up in a couple of weeks, maybe next week, will put the OCO at $79 billion and change, and the main budget at $526 billion. Which isn't anywhere near any of the numbers that you and Ryan are writing about.
No, and it's almost like it's where they are, so it's the bill they have to bring up. And if you don't have a different number, what do you go to? But and particularly in that OCO budget, in the overseas budget, you have considerable amount of money there that really should be in that base $526 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then so that actually makes it even harder to bring that $526 billion down to the $475 billion that would be the final BCA cap.
So this is not – although we can derive some comfort from some of the things we're seeing, there is still some very heavy lifting here is what it sounds like, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, particularly with OCO, it's one of those situations where it's a short-term benefit with a real long-term danger. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, we're far from out of the woods no matter where we stand tomorrow.
And look at it this way. Even if they reach agreement on a number for fiscal year 14, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, worst-case scenario, that number is at the Budget Control Act cap, $475 billion for DOD in the base budget. What does that mean for subsequent years? Do you assume you're going to get well the following year, and mm-hmm. so you'll make some more decisions to punt rather than absorb the cost now? Or do you assume, in fact, that new $475 billion is the level at which you're going to be on out into the future? You make very different decisions depending on where you're going to make those cuts, depending on whether or not you think you're at that level just for 1 year or you're going to be at that level for years to come.
Well, when I listen to Secretary Hagel and Secretary Hale talk about these issues, what I hear them saying, although they don't say it explicitly, is they're starting to recognize that the lower number, planning lower is planning better, is what it sounds like the strategy is that they're employing. Is that a fair inference on that
I think
part?
It is. Secretary Hagel, of course, was at CSIS back early in November, and he all but said that you know, it's more important that we get a lower number with certainty that we can begin to plan for and execute toward than it is to fight for the higher number. That's not an explicit statement, but that's an inference of what he said.
And it fits with the curve that I think we've seen he and Secretary Hale take, and also Secretary Carter when he's talked about these things. The tack that we've seen them take is they've tried to kind of give clues as to where they see this headed.
And, you know, typically this is what the military chiefs of the military services want.
Mm-hmm.
Their view is, tell me what my number is and let me figure out how to get you the best military capability I can get you for that number. Don't nickel and dime me around the edges and then expect me to pull the pieces back together.
We've talked about the Quadrennial Defense Review earlier, and historically that document, as you said, Dave, hasn't had numbers attached to it. But that's just tradition more than anything else. Is it maybe time for that tradition to go away, Ryan, and that we should see maybe not the number first and then the capability behind it, but more of a concerted effort within the QDR process and finished product to see some kind of at least illusion to the fact that there is a budget constraint here now?
Yeah, I think that unfair question. You're asking a guy who does defense budgets whether the budget should be more important or as at least more part of the conversation.
So you're a little biased.
So
fair disclosure.
You know, I wonder whether the 2012 strategic guidance process was a sign that may be a growing piece of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, particularly under this administration, wonder if that will continue. But it certainly suggests that while pie-in-the-sky strategy is good, I don't know how helpful it is. And so the interaction between the two is very important. I very much hope that it's at least becoming a more recognized piece of the process. And, you know, that how big that piece is to be determined by others than me. But I do think that's an important consideration.
And the value of strategy in circumstances like this is not just because it lays out what you want to do and gives you a basis for planning. It also gives you a basis for prioritizing what's more important than something else and for making trade-off decisions within those competing factions so that you say, okay, I'm going to give less to you and more to this because this is more important and it fits my priorities better.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a basis for that. Otherwise, you're just kind of guessing at each one and making a case-by-case decision. If you want an integrated defense strategy with an integrated defense budget, you've got to have a process that does that.
We've talked a lot in the times that we've discussed this before, gentlemen, about flexibilities, and we hear that word all the time, especially in the last 6-8 months on the defense budget. At what point does giving the department flexibility to move money around become a deference of responsibility when Congress is supposed to be the appropriating organization here and is supposed to be determining what's on each budget line and what those budget lines say?
We had an on-the-record discussion at CSIS on November 5th that actually raised this very question to a series of former appropriations staff directors.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you the link so you can put it up on your website. And Jim Dyer, who was the former chief clerk of the House Appropriations Committee, said, I would personally rather give them more money and a tighter leash mm-hmm. rather than less money and more flexibility because Congress has to exercise its responsibility here. I'm not sure where the executive branch would come down in that regard, but I think from Article 1 of the Constitution point of view, there is a congressional requirement there to have that oversight, if you will.
And that's what I'm kind of getting at, Ryan, because it would be very easy in from an organization that seems to like to punt that responsibility and come back a year, 2 years, or whatever later conducting oversight and say, well, we don't like the way you did that. Well, you had an opportunity to do something about it and chose not to.
Right, and I think that's exactly what these negotiations going on right now are all about, is giving Congress the opportunity. And I think that there have been a lot of opportunities for it. And while this may not be the last, this suggests that this is not the last, but we are coming up on a point where really you've begun to see the authority of the Congress. And I think that that a decision by the Budget Committee, some appropriations coming out of this, is really the best-case scenario. I think it's good for the executive and for the legislative branches to actually get back to a regular order type system.
Defense is really in a bit of a trap here, right? Because they know that they're suffering from these reductions. And the descriptions that the chiefs give when they go up to testify actually have some weight, if you will. But the visibility of those takes time. And at the same time, anytime the call goes of, we need you to do this mission right now, this fast, the tendency of DOD is, we can do whatever job you give us, mm-hmm. right? And so they're in some ways working at cross purposes with themselves. They'll stretch to the limit to deliver that which the nation requires and that which the president commands. And yet at the same time, they know that internally there's a suffering that's going on. How long do you have to wait before – how visible does the proof need to be before Congress actually accepts and says, okay, now we have to deal with this?
That's Dave Bertel of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and joining me in studio for Pentagon Solutions today with his colleague Ryan Crotty.